This is Alex Peace of the States Gazette with Nicholas McAlpine Lee of Halo Housing, who have just bought a registered provider for their shared ownership model, or the expansion of. Nick, thank you ever so much for joining me. I guess the best thing to start with would basically be, what's Halo, in your own words?
Thank you, Alex. Halo was founded in 2014, and we are a joint venture with Lancashire County Council, and we were cornerstone funded by the Lancashire County Pension Fund, which has pooled its assets with the London Pension Funds Authority, and effectively has created the local pensions partnership. The Halo business is similar to most housing associations, but different in one key respect, in that we only really focus on shared ownership as the affordable housing tenure that we deliver. Our business plan is therefore relatively straightforward. We raise money from institutional investors. We deploy that, acquiring shared ownership properties, delivering affordable housing to the 86% of people who aspire to have ownership, but the majority of which can't afford it. And the shared ownership properties then produce very long-dated rental income streams that are inflation-linked. And it's that inflation linkage which is incredibly important and attractive to institutional investors like Lancashire County Pension Fund, because of course it matches the liabilities that they have in the pension fund itself.
So what's a typical deal? Do you buy a whole block, or do you build a whole block yourselves, or do you, when a normal regular house builder builds 500 units and 100 from the shared ownership, you take the 100 off them? I mean, what's typical for you, chapter?
Good question. So far, we have acquired 1,000 units, just shy of 1,000 units of properties in over 120 local authorities across the country. The word typical probably doesn't apply to most of those. We have four main routes to acquiring shared ownership properties in the business and delivering shared ownership housing. The first one, which is where we started, was actually bulk purchasing existing portfolios from landlords who want to release that capital investment and go on and deliver some more housing. So we bought, for example, Bellway Housing Trust portfolio from Bellway House Builder, and they've recycled that capital back into their business. The second route that we acquire stock from is working in partnership with house builders. As you're aware, house builders need to deliver affordable housing as part of Section 106 planning requirements. And we are similar to other housing associations active in that space, in that we want to sign contracts with house builders to acquire those properties that are required under the planning conditions. One of the main differences is that Halo as a business has tried to, for its investors, remove as much risk as we can from the way that we operate, and therefore we can raise our money at a very low comparative rate. So things that we don't do, for example, is take development risk. We don't take large volume sales risk. So when we engage with house builders, one of the important features of our offer is, Mr. House Builder or Mrs. House Builder, you do what you're good at. You're good at building and you're good at selling. We want you to, and we will help you identify shared ownership buyers, of which there are many more buyers for these properties than potentially for private units, and more than help to buy. But we'll help you find the people, we'll direct them to your sales force, but actually we only really want to acquire the properties at the point the customer's ready to move in. What that means for house builders is they are free to build what they want, where they want, to charge a market rate for it, and that they're in control of their entire site. And that's attractive, that has some soft benefits and is attractive for a number of reasons. What it also means is, because we're not taking the sales risk, unlike housing associations that might offer builders 60% of open market value for a contract 3 years prior to the house being built, we say, well, actually, we will offer you a percentage of the value at the point the property is sold in the future. So in London and the South East in particular, that could be quite a lot higher in 3 years' time than it was 3 years ago. But you can keep the profit on the sale of the share because you're taking the sales risk. Mm. So in a very simplistic example, if it's a £200,000 property housing association would typically give a builder £120,000, 60%, and then they'd go on and sell, let's say, a 50% share for £100,000, meaning that they get some profit and some cross-subsidy, and the bit that's left only costs the housing association £20,000, but they've taken the risk. Flipping that to our model, the house builder makes the first sale and keeps the receipt, so they get £100,000, and then we give them 60% of the open market value of what's left, so they get £160,000 with our model. And the real reason why we're able to do that is, one, we've got our cost of funding down through removing those risks in the first place, and two, we don't need the cross-subsidy, the profit on the sale of the share, that housing associations do, because typically they use that to subsidise other tenures, and of course we don't do that.
So you're just essentially linking the income back into your own model to pay to your shareholders on this. You don't need to reinvest it for extra development.
Correct, yeah. Absolutely correct. So it's quite a simple model, it's different. It requires the builder to do something they haven't done before in terms of shared ownership, but it is requiring them to do something that they do every day of their life in terms of building and selling houses.
So what's the appetite being from the house builders?
Very strong. We are in contract or have contracted with 8 of the 10 top PLC house builders in the country. We're on our second, if not third or fourth, deals with very large regional house builders across the country. We do business with even very small house builders. And we cover the entire market, from sites where the affordable output might be 5 units all the way up to where the affordable output might be 150 units. Really, the appetite has been so strong that actually that's what led us to go and look at acquiring registered provider status.
So this is the bit which I'm finding confusing for the moment. Why have you bought a registered provider? Why not just apply for registered provider status? You've bought Preconditions, who I think were a dormant housing association.
They were an intending provider. They were registered in 2011, but they hadn't actually acquired a unit of housing as affordable housing, therefore become a provider. And that was quite key to identifying registered providers for acquisition that were reasonably clean and quite easy to get hold of. Why acquire one rather than register? The simple answer is time. Towards the end of last summer, we commissioned Savills to investigate how long it would take us to become registered versus whether it was possible for us to acquire a registered provider that was reasonably clean and willing to sell, and therefore acquire the status through a corporate acquisition. Savills went out to the market, identified 3 not-for-profit housing associations, for-profit housing associations that had been registered over the preceding 5 years or so. Those for-profit housing associations, those 3 of them have... 2 of them did already have stock, and 1 of them, Preconditions, was empty. I think it's fair to say Preconditions from 2011 had been trying to do a shared ownership style institutional investment style model that is very, very similar to Halo's actual model. So when we engaged with the principals of that business, there was a recognition, a meeting of minds, that actually that's what they set out to do, but just hadn't managed to crack the walnut, so to speak. Mm-hmm. It's quite difficult. And the reason we went for RP status in the first place was, when you're delivering shared ownership housing in the UK, there are two challenges that you'll face if you're not a registered provider. The first one is that the majority of mortgage banks will provide shared ownership mortgages, but only to the customers of landlords who are registered providers. So if as a landlord you don't have the status, then there are mortgages available from mortgage banks, and we had very strong relations with a handful of mortgage banks who were providing mortgages to us, but we didn't have access to the full 15 to 20 mortgage banks that are out there in the market. And what that means for your customers is you're making it more difficult for your customers.
Well, not just them, if they want to sell on in the future, then it will be different. If there are restrictions on who they can sell to, that can impact
them. Absolutely. And we were being very careful and being very responsible about just the volume we were putting through. So we had more opportunities to transact than we were comfortable with because of the mortgage supply. The second aspect really is that because there hasn't, historically there haven't been many non-registered providers operating in the affordable housing space, Section 106 agreements are typically drafted with a registered provider in mind. So typically the Section 106 agreement will anticipate that the affordable housing is disposed to a registered provider registered with the HCA. Mm. If you're not one, what that means is the builder needs to go back in and renegotiate the 106, which they don't often want to do because they want to get on building. So what it meant for our business model is that more often than not, we were brought in by the local authorities on sites where there were problems because the traditional sector didn't want to acquire the units, or the bids were too low, that meant that there was a viability issue, and we were being brought in, but it was still another piece of work for the house builders to do.
Did the, I haven't really gone into the support you've received from government and or, you know, sort of consultations with government, but did they or their various organs want you to become registered, if that makes sense, in that you are, as you say, providing affordable housing, but you were unregulated compared to the rest of the sector?
No, in our engagement with all stakeholders, there was a recognition that the previous government administrations had called for an opening up of the affordable housing market and for new entrants to come forwards, and not necessarily in a registered provider format. Mm. And certainly the 2017-21 grant programme being opened up to non-RPs had already been announced. I think in Mr Osborne's last autumn budget there had been statements about opening up the market and trying to expand the delivery and the focus on shared ownership. Mm. So the when we engaged with stakeholders, you know, HCA, CLG, the mortgage banks themselves, there was a wide recognition that things probably needed to change to facilitate that opening up, and there was never really a suggestion of, well, why don't you just go and get registered, surely that'll be easier and we don't have to change anything. That certainly wasn't any pushback that we ever received.
But you found that anyway.
But well, what we did get was particularly things like, you know, planning policy is not something that's easily changed overnight. Things like mortgage lending policies, shared ownership mortgage business is important to the mortgage banks that provide it, but it's a small part of what they do. So anything that involves system changes takes quite a long time. And because these aspects were holding back our business, effectively, one of the decisions that we faced was, do we continue to wait? And effectively, it slows down the pace of our investment, the pace of our growth, and more importantly, the pace of delivery of this tenure, which is incredibly important. Or do we find a way round it, mm-hmm. or through it?
Well, yes, waiting for some kind of policy or planning thing.
The new government and Brexit had caused delays in some of that as well, and actually the policy has migrated to a much more wider policy on all things housing, as we've seen, which is good. I think, you know, the idea of having a policy which is, it starts off with the first thing, which is let's just build houses and homes, and the second thing does need to follow, which in my view, which is, and let's make what the 10 years we deliver reflect what the people actually want. So if 80%+ of people want to aspire to ownership, we should try and support them in doing that. When Savills came back and said, actually look, we think it's going to be 6 to 12 months for registration, but we found an existing clean registered provider that the principals of which are probably interested in selling to you because you're doing what they wanted to set off to do in the first place. It became very apparent that when we met them in December, we completed the transaction by the end of January, mm-hmm. And then renamed the Three Conditions Housing to Halo Housing Registered Provider Limited. I know it's not very imaginative, but at least it does describe what we are. And the last few weeks we've been spending just bedding that down and making sure it's ready to kind of kick off and get going.
I mean, are you allowed to, well obviously you are, but how does buying a registered provider work? Because previously it's always been essentially mergers, hasn't it, between them? Do they have an open market value? How much did you pay for it?
I can't disclose the sum because one of the things that we put as part of the contract is that we would consult with each other about disclosing anything that wasn't in the public domain, so apologies for that. But to say that the cost of acquiring the RP in our case, which was empty, bear in mind, usually you'd have to acquire the properties as well. We were just acquiring the business. Was not dissimilar and represented good value for money compared to a registration process that Savills had gone through. And I think some of them are longer than others. But actually, I think it was important for us to make sure that it didn't really matter one way or another. So it really just came down to an opportunity to save time and, and effort, quite frankly, and direct our time and effort elsewhere. In terms of the acquisition, and you're right, I think this is the first time that a for-profit registered provider has changed hands. In the not-for-profit sector, where there's stock, usually that's mergers, transfers, etc., etc., it's reasonably simple. You need to notify the HCA, and indeed both parties engage with the HCA on a full disclosure basis because that's the sensible way to engage with the regulator. We acquired the shares of the business. Obviously we needed to make sure that the entity was clean and the liabilities were all sorted out, that if there were any. But it was no more difficult than acquiring shares in a limited company and then changing its name at company's house. I think what this has kicked off, and I know that Savills are investigating other for-profit providers, is that this is in response to the government's white paper about stimulating institutional investment into shared ownership and wider into affordable housing, but in shared ownership in particular, this presents quite an interesting innovation in terms of how you might be able to access a platform and an investment model that could work that way.
Could an M&G or an L&G buy a social housing provider which has 1,000 units of stock?
If it was a for-profit one, I guess they could. I mean, I guess the reality of the way that even not-for-profit housing associations, if they're companies limited by guarantee, acquiring the members' interest means that you acquire the business. Whether they would want to do that is, I couldn't possibly comment. I suspect potentially not, but there would have been certainly nothing stopping other people emulating a Halo type model. There are challenges around finding institutional investors, and I think this is where the government's call and the white paper is important. The cash flows that come off shared ownership are very long, inflation linked, with an inflation linked mechanic that matches or is better than the inflation linkage in underlying pensions. So there's a natural synergy between these two markets. But one of the challenges that you find is that in large institutional investment businesses, people can invest in inflation, but they can't invest in credit. And people can invest in credit, but it can't be inflation linked. And we're starting to see, with a couple of transactions recently, we're starting to see the opening up of the crossover between these two mandates, if you like, in institutional investment terms. But there's still a long way to go. I think that the wider institutional investment market and returns more generally are a great opportunity right now to drive and push on institutional investment in the sector.
Well, you've said you've raised £300 million so far.
Correct.
And that's all from institutions, basically. You've gone out to
it's
the market.
It's all from Lancashire County Pension Fund, essentially.
So there is huge potential, then, for further institutional investment to essentially invest in housing stock and returns, basically, and long-dated.
It's enormous. The local government pension schemes alone have got £220 billion of investments, of which a very small allocation to shared ownership, for example, would match the government's 2017-21 delivery programme. So, just a small sub 3% investment by the LGPS schemes would deliver the same again as the government has put in. But then if you put that to a wider context in the UK, there's over £3 trillion of pension fund money. And now you're talking about an investment that probably matches the £60 billion or so that's already been invested over the past 30 or 40 years into the affordable housing market housing association sector, which has delivered social rented properties largely.
What's your IRR? Or can you disclose what sort of returns you've been delivering?
The bonds are publicly listed on the Irish Stock Exchange. They've been structured as fully amortising index-linked bonds, and they've been structured into two tranches, a short one, which is about 38 years, and a long one, which goes all the way out to 68 years. And the reason for doing that is that if you hold them in different proportions, so two to one or one to one, you can manufacture what's known as duration to be able to match your liability profile of your fund. Some investors are more interested in short ones, some investors more interested in long ones, and very long dated inflation linked investment opportunities are quite unusual. And in fact, we invented this structure.
Especially backed by housing stock.
Yes, and backed by backed by an asset class that's got probably 60 million homes above it that in macro stress environments start to move into your demand pool. But from that perspective, the investor can choose and manufacture something that properly matches their liability profile. If you hold them 2-1, the return that you get is just over 2% as a coupon above inflation, and then you get the amortization profile as well, because at the end of 68 years the bonds are fully repaid, so there's no refinance risk. And what we really did was look at securitization type approaches with some infrastructure finance type technology, and then trying to remove as many risks as possible and give pension funds exactly what they want. I guess one of the things that's probably key to point out really is that private investment in this space isn't new. Index-linked bonds aren't new. Amortizing bonds aren't new. Investing in a housing association certainly isn't new. £60 billion of bonds in there. Investing in shared ownership is probably quite new. You know, traditionally, the banks didn't really fund it. The institutional investors haven't really got it in security pools supporting their bonds. But I think that's starting to change, and hopefully with the white paper we'll push on that. Halo's not, it's innovative, but it hasn't really truly invented anything wholly new. What we've done is we've brought together different aspects and different technologies and put it together in what we hope is the most sensible way to match one thing with another and remove as many risks in the process.
Could you open it up to retail investors?
Yes, and we have looked at that. I think that there is in the world of buy-to-lets, the market having a tough time at the moment. You've obviously spotted the same thing that we have. I think that we've looked at the retail bond market, and I've got to say at the moment there's a bit of a disconnect in the retail. Sorry, it's an ambulance going past. There's a bit of a disconnect in the retail bond market in terms of return expectations compared to the wholesale markets. I see retail bond issuances going out through the orb with quite high returns on them, much higher than you would expect even in a commercial environment. And I think at the moment, what that means is that money would be quite expensive, and therefore the housing we deliver with it would be quite expensive, which is not the point. Going forwards, the idea here is to what we call balance the triangle. So we're balancing the triangle between what the investors need as a return, a long-dated return to underpin pension liabilities in a matched environment with a very low risk profile, to what the house builders need as pence in the pound to make it interesting for them to continue to build and build more with what the customers can pay, so that we create sufficient supply of customers or demand to make sure that this continues to go around. And it's balancing all the corners of that triangle. At the moment, the retail market's probably too expensive to make the triangle balance.
Have you been speaking to sort of other institutions? Authorities. I'm thinking someone like the GLA, and there are various election pledges would quite like a sort of large-scale fund to invest in shared ownership or something like that.
Yes, we are engaged with the team at the GLA. Obviously the mayor's pledges to increase housing, to strike a 35% target and if possible move it to 50%. Shared ownership, and the fact that models like ours, indeed our model, can deliver higher percentages of open market value, make actually larger levels of delivery more realistic. So we're engaged with the GLA. They've also got some kind of challenge funds and pots of capital that they would like to innovate with. So we're in discussions partnering with them. We're also working with the HCA under their continuous market engagement. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, we are, whilst we're not a recipient of grant under the AHP, we are supporting the non-RP recipients, of which there are some very large recipients, in so much that they want to build and they want to sell a shared ownership, but obviously those businesses are development contractor businesses. They don't really want to hold the landlord's portion beyond that point, and obviously that's the bit that we're interested in. So there's a natural synergy of us supporting their delivery. Obviously the LPFA's involvement in our structure through its partnership with Lancashire and London Pension Funds Authority. Sir Merrick Cockell is going to be speaking at our event this evening, and certainly his involvement in the GLA and involvement with the mayor in terms of LPFA's involvement more widely means that we are very much involved in GLA conversations. Mm-hmm. But I think it goes beyond that into regional conversations across the whole of what you would see as being the HCA delivery or GLA delivery programs here.
I think specifically for the GLA, they say roughly a third for their affordable percentages, you know, shared ownership, social rent, and another of choice. Outside of London, shared ownership, it can be sort of up to, you know, the entire affordable percentage, the 35%, can't it? I'm thinking about the scalability of your model, basically, and how many schemes would, you know, the ability to expand it almost like that.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, we see sites where it's 80-20 rented versus shared ownership all the way to the inverse of that and beyond into 100% shared ownership. A lot of our delivery at the moment is coming northwest, midlands, southwest. For different reasons. Northwest, just the sheer volume of house buildings going on in the northwest at the moment is enormous. Mm-hmm. And the housing association market, I think, is whilst there are some very strong players, some very good players up there, they've got capacity. They've also put in big grant allocations. I think a large proportion of the SOAP that's been announced has gone to the north of the country, because £30,000 of grant goes further where the OMVs are sub 200k. So there's an awful lot going on in there, but because of just the sheer volume of delivery that's going on there, we're seeing an awful lot of opportunity. Mm. There's also a number of kind of discounted market sales schemes that are struggling with mortgage supply that are being converted towards shared ownership where mortgage supply is easier. Mm-hmm. And we're certainly engaging and supporting where there's problems. In the Midlands, again, I think prior to the announcement of the affordable housing programme, the established housing associations were very, very active, but actually a lot of those have also recipients of grants under the programme. So there's more to be done there. So in terms of scalability, that's great. I think one of the thing in the southwest, it's more about the fact that there's so many sites and they're smaller. Mm. So the larger housing associations, because it's the same amount of work to do a scheme with 10 units as it is to do a scheme with 50 units, they're migrating to larger schemes. And because our model doesn't get involved in the same level of detail and things like employers, agents, etc., that HAs were typically involved with, we leave the builders to build. We can look at smaller schemes, so it's a slightly different dynamic in that marketplace. Mm-hmm.
How big would you like to get in the next 5 years? What would be good?
Well, we set ourselves a target of $1 billion by 2020 invested. We're in discussions with institutional investors securing another $500 million at the moment. But I'd like to think that with the call for action from the white paper and a renewed focus on shared ownership and potentially Halo having quietly, hopefully, got on with some things for something positive for the last 2 years, and not really, we've now got something to talk about that we've actually done rather than talking about something we're going to do. Mm. My personal ambition for the business is to be coming out to the market to be raising £400 to £600 million a year and increasing supply. I mean, right now the business has a forward pipeline of delivery of 2,000 units over the next 18 to 24 months, which I think already puts us in the top 10 shared ownership delivery providers in the UK at the moment, mm-hmm. in terms of scale. But to put it in context, £1 billion invested is somewhere in the region of 7,000 to 8,000 units of shared ownership housing. So we'd like to be doing kind of 3,000 to 4,000 units a year.
Mm-hmm. The final question from my side is, what are the risks that come not just with RP status, but with shared ownership investing? So obviously, as a part of shared ownership, you can buy your chunk of the flat. So does that mean you can see stock almost disappear? And secondly, you know, as all the housing associations have seen over the last 3 or 4 years, the government can step in and do things which will ruin your ability to go to the market, basically. And
it's a very good question, and it's certainly one that investors challenge us on quite rightly. When I talked earlier about the routes that we have to acquiring stock, we can bulk purchase from existing landlords. So, for example, the housing association sector at the moment has got 200,000 shared ownership properties. They're probably worth somewhere in the region of £12 billion, and that stock presents an asset management opportunity for existing housing associations to release capital and then reinvest in new supply. And I think there's a fledgling market starting to build in there. The third way we've been active in trying to make sure that we can invest not just additional proceeds from investors, but anything that comes out of our portfolio back into shared ownership, is in partnership with local authorities and helping them redeploy their right to buy receipts. So one of the challenges that exists in the market at the moment is the challenge of one-for-one replacement if a right to buy a property is sold, local authorities are capped at 30% of capital investment in that next property. Well, if you think of the way that shared ownership works, shared ownership makes occupation of a unit of housing affordable through buying a share. But when you buy your share, you get to live in the whole house. The same concept could apply to a corporate purchaser. So in our let share model, the local authorities use their 30% right to buy receipts and buy a share of a property. But because they're local authorities, we allow them to sublet that property as rented stock. So there's another way that we're increasing the scale and deployment of capital, and that's why we're confident in getting this money, not only raising it, but also getting it invested. And then the fourth way, and this is the bit where I think we're trying to remove some of the other dynamics of what you've highlighted being a political or wider market interference, is that actually there's 200,000 people on waiting lists for shared ownership right now. Last year, the outturn of shared ownership supply was probably somewhere between 6 to 8,000 properties. So that's quite a long wait, unfortunately, for the people on the waiting list. That doesn't mean to say they don't want to buy. It doesn't mean to say they don't have deposits. They're just waiting for new build properties to come to the market. And HAs will readily report that they've got 20 buyers for every property, if not more. One of the things is that actually that market needs to be served. So we created a do-it-yourself shared ownership offer where once people are qualified, they can go out into estate agents, Rightmove, Zoopla, Purple Bricks, Tepelo, whichever, find a property, and then Halo will act as a cash buyer and turn that into shared ownership. And what that means for us is that going beyond that 200,000 marketplace, you know, 86% of people want to own, there's probably at least 2 million people in PRS at the moment who probably do have some savings but can't access on a full mortgage basis because where they want to live, they can't get the mortgage multiples. And therefore, a shared ownership offer would really appeal to them. So we can go beyond that 200,000 already identified marketplace into several million marketplace of people who are aspirational homeowners, but in many cases, particularly as you move further away from London and the South East, probably aren't even aware that shared ownership exists. Mm. Quite often in the North West, the first question we get asked by a prospective buyer is, who am I sharing with? The government's got a part to play in that, but in terms of the marketplace, it is gigantic.
So it wouldn't, to wrap it up slightly, first to say, you're never going to be able to stop the threat of regulation, and there will always be a trickle of stock as people buy it off, but the market is frankly huge, and the potential for it means that it's not going to go anywhere anytime soon.
Yes, because the aspiration for ownership, you're absolutely right, the marketplace is enormous. Buying a 25% share of a property is cheaper than renting privately in almost every local authority in the UK. So if they're on a mass market, if actually delivery could keep pace with demand, if tomorrow in every town in Britain a billboard went up saying, did you know that buying could be cheaper than renting, and here's how, almost like a why rent when you could buy approach. Not everyone's going to have the deposits, but bearing in mind that these deposits are much smaller than Help to Buy deposits, and you're appealing to a marketplace which isn't crossing into anyone that can afford to use Help to Buy or private outright purchase. This is a completely new marketplace. Yet demand is enormous, mm-hmm. and the only things that really will affect that are no longer having a desire to own a property in the UK. So people can take a personal or a long-term view on that. I think that's highly unlikely for a good many years to come. Or some massive house price correction that means that all of a sudden properties in the UK are suddenly affordable for everyone. And I don't think that actually as a country, economically, that would be a particularly great place to be when you look at who currently has the property wealth and then what they're going to do with it as they get slightly older and funding the NHS, for example. So there are some larger macro features here. Of the 23 million homes in Britain, 16 million are owned outright or with a mortgage. You've then got 4 million that are private rented. You've then got a thin sliver of about 200,000 which are shared ownership. And then you've got the social rented properties, 4 million of which sitting beneath that. And in order, that is the order of affordability. So, I think we're fine here. And the idea, you're right, the idea of people staircasing, as the term is known, slight misnomer, because it's quite expensive to do, so people don't do it in pieces. But the idea that at some point in the future people could buy the property outright means that our model gets that capital, and all we do with it is redeploy it back into more shared ownership. And that is quite a simple model, which is if it comes to us, it comes to us at market value. We put it back into the market through our do-it-yourself product and then help someone into ownership.
Well, Nick, from my perspective, that's all questions, and thank you very much. But is there anything you'd like to add to it?
No, just thank you for your time. Very nice to speak to you.